You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Well, folks, I trust you had a most wonderful holiday. Christmas, Hanukkah, whatever it was that you celebrated, I really sincerely hope that that it was a good one for you and for yours. Tonight, I want to talk a little bit about that. I'm going to give you some recipes, too. If you want them, I mean, you don't have to write them down, but if you want some really good recipes, I'm going to give you a couple of my secrets. So if you'd like to write them down, you can. We had a great Christmas here. Doyle went home to be with his family the day after Christmas and is still there. He'll be back sometime tomorrow. All of the others who help us in our security effort had a wonderful Christmas. The girls were ecstatic. It wasn't the biggest Christmas they've ever had. They didn't get a whole lot this year, but what they got made them very happy. Really simple things, to tell you the truth. And, of course, for me, Christmas is actually my whole Christmas is looking at the children. I wouldn't care if I never received a gift on Christmas, because to me, the whole thing is when they come running down the stairs just to see their face. When they see what is there for them under the tree, and watch them when they open their presents. Now, we get some get some real weird responses to this. Like, I know I'm going to get some letters from people, maybe even some phone calls from people who want to know, Why do you celebrate Christmas? You know it's a pagan celebration. Ladies and gentlemen, it's only a pagan celebration if you're celebrating a pagan event. Do you understand what I'm telling you? If you're worshiping a tree, then of course Christmas is the old pagan tree worship of Northern Europe. But we don't do that here. The tree is merely a decoration. It's traditional. We give gifts in remembrance of the presence of the three wise men who traveled from a long way away in order to bring gold, frankincense, and myrrh to the baby Jesus on Christmas. We celebrate the birth of Jesus. And we know that this is not the day that Jesus was born, that it is in fact the winter solstice. But we are not worshiping the sun, nor are we celebrating the winter solstice. We are practicing a tradition. We are celebrating the birth of Jesus. No one really knows the exact exact date upon which he was born, although in our research, I believe we've come pretty close to it. And he wasn't born in the year that most people believe that he was born. All of these things have been changed over the years, misinterpreted, mistranslated. The dates have been changed to meld different religions with each other in order to prevent conflict. We know all of that. In fact, most of you wouldn't know it if you hadn't been listening to this broadcast. I'm the one who told it to you. So I don't need a letter telling me that I'm some kind of a terrible person because we celebrated Christmas. Or that I don't know what I'm doing because it's really the winter solstice and all of that kind of stuff. We celebrated the birth of Jesus on a traditional celebration day. We do that because we believe that his birth should be remembered. We also do it because it's a great time for the children. And even though they may not understand all of the mysteries connected with the religious basis for the purpose of the celebration, it's a time to tell them stories that will lead to that understanding. It's a time to answer their questions. But most of all, it's a time for family to be together, to be with each other, and to show your love for one another, in my estimation, by the giving of gifts. And for me, the very best of it, the icing on the cake, so to speak, is watching the children. I enjoy that more than anything. I love my children. I love them more than I could ever communicate to anyone. And to see them happy and hear their laughter and help them learn how to use their new gifts or put them together. Or in Allison's case, take her outside and hold her while she learns to pedal her new bicycle that does not have any training wheels. And listen to her squeals of delight and the look of wonderment upon her face. She got a computer this year. Who's had a computer for a long time? Allison got a computer this year. She's 3 years old. And she loves it. So we're going to talk about Christmas tonight. And I'm going to give you some recipes, a couple of recipes. Some people around here have told me not to do this because it's my claim to fame on Christmas, but I don't care. You know, I've never been looking for any fame. What I like to do is, I guess I should preface this because I guess you guys don't know it. In this family, I cook Thanksgiving and Christmas dinner. And it's not just me. When Pooh, I guess when she reached about 4, she began to help me. So Pooh and I, that's my oldest daughter, Pooh and I cook Thanksgiving dinner and Christmas dinner every year. And before Pooh began to help me, I did it alone. So I've got some, I get a great turkey recipe and a great dressing recipe. And I'm going to give it to those of you tonight who want to write it down and give it a try. And I guarantee it will be the best, most perfectly cooked, moistest, perfectly browned turkey you've ever cooked in your life. And once you put it in the oven, you never even have to open the oven door. You never have to check on it. You never have to look at it. You never have to baste it. Nothing. All you have to do is leave it alone for the time period that I tell you, and When that time has expired, you open the oven door, and the most beautiful turkey you've ever seen in your life will be staring you in the face. It will be the moistest turkey that you've ever had. None of it will be dried out. And literally, after you let it cool for a little while and you go to carve it, the meat will literally fall right off the bones. It is delicious. Don't go away. Be right back. Ladies and gentlemen, we've got two guests in the studio tonight.
Hello.
Who are you?
Allison.
Allison?
Allison W.
Yes?
Allison W. Cooper.
Allison W. Cooper. And?
And I'm Dorothy Cooper.
You're Dorothy Cooper.
Dorothy Marie Cooper.
Okay, you need to talk a little bit closer or a little bit louder. I'd prefer that you talk louder rather than closer.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
You want to tell everybody about your Christmas?
Yeah.
Were you excited about it?
Oh, yeah. I just couldn't wait until I got my hands on one little present, but I had to wait.
And what did you do the day before on Christmas Eve?
Well, I wrapped presents.
What else?
And I waited for Christmas to come. It didn't come very fast, though.
Did you make something?
I made a couple of cards, and I hung them on the Christmas tree.
You forgot the snack. What did you leave for Santa Claus?
Oh, I left him.
Can you talk a lot louder, honey?
I left some cookies and milk for him.
And how about you?
I just opened my kid and then I see a bug.
Okay. So what happened on Christmas Eve? Did you guys go to bed early or what?
Well, we didn't go to bed pretty early, but we waited, I guess, until maybe around 9 o'clock.
Yeah? And then what happened?
And then after that, we went to bed, and then we woke up on Christmas morning, and then we were so excited. I kept on telling Allison, wake up, it's Christmas. And she woke up, and we got dressed, and we brushed our teeth, and we did everything that we got ready, and then we went downstairs. And as soon as we saw the Christmas tree.
Well, wait a minute. What did you see before you went downstairs?
Before I went downstairs?
Didn't you see something in the living room?
Oh, yeah, I
see. Allison, what did you see in the living room when you came downstairs?
I see Santa Claus hat and I see cookies. Well, we didn't see any cookies, but we saw the milk all gone and we saw the cookies all gone. And Santa Claus left his hat there.
Wow, that's amazing. Were you surprised to see Santa Claus's hat? You have to talk, honey. They cannot see you.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. What color was it?
Red and white.
Oh. Were you excited?
Yeah.
And then what did you do?
Well, we went downstairs, and as soon as we saw the Christmas tree with all the presents and stuff, we were so, so happy to see all of them there.
And?
And we went over there. And Allison had a new bike.
Did you have a new bike? When did you see it?
And there were teddy bears on that.
Oh, there was teddy bears on that bike, huh?
White and brown.
What did your bike look like?
It's like pink and white.
Pink and white. Wow. Is that what you wanted?
Yeah. And the wheels were white and the pedal was pink.
Oh, the pedals were pink. I see. So then what happened?
Well, we opened our presents, and I think Allison got to go first. I don't remember, but one of us went first. Maybe we went both at the same time. And Allison opened one present, and then I did. And the first present that Allison got, I don't know. Allison, what present did you get first?
I get a ladybug in snow.
You got
She can't remember. But she remembers her ladybug.
Yeah. And we all got ladybugs. And then we opened some more presents. And we had... Allison got a calendar. And I had a calendar too. We both had calendars. And then after that, we opened our other presents up, and
what did you get, Allison?
I get...
Talk in there.
I get...
Don't you remember what you got? How about a computer?
Whoa. You all right, Ellie?
Come on, get up here.
Yeah.
Now, tell what you got.
I got a computer, a nice computer.
And
I got.
Oh, so hard to remember. Well, Pooh, you want to wrap it up?
Okay. Well, and then I got another present, and it was an easel. And I got to draw on there, and I do it almost every day now since Christmas.
You like art, huh?
Mm-hmm.
You want to tell about the dinner that you fixed?
Oh, before on Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
That was before Christmas. Me and my dad were fixing turkey. And we stuffed it. We made the stuffing and we stuffed the turkey. And I dried the turkey and he washed it before everything. And so I dried it. And then after that, we put the stuffing in there. But before we put the stuffing in there, he salted the cavities. And then after that, he put the stuffing in.
Well, didn't we have to chop a lot of things first?
Oh, yeah.
And mix it together?
Yeah.
Okay. And then what did we do?
Well, we chopped all the stuff, mushrooms and celery and onions, and we put them in there, and then we put chicken broth in there, and we put wine in there, and we put the stuffing in there. And then after that, when it was all done, we got the turkey and we put the stuffing in there.
Then what did you do with the turkey?
Oh, we put it in the oven.
And then what?
And then we
went to bed.
Yeah, we went to bed.
Okay, girls. You want to tell everybody Happy New Year? Come on up, Allison. Allison is 3 years old, and she's like a little worm, just crawling all over the place.
Okay, you ready to say Happy New Year? Okay. Happy New Year, everybody.
Okay, guys. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Appreciate your help. Well, they didn't know they were going to do that. I just called them and asked them if they would like to while the music was playing, and they said yes, they would like to. What you heard, the sound like a disaster, was Allison slipping off the chair that she was standing on. She, you know, like all small children, she cannot be still, and we don't even try to make her be still because it's not going to happen. It just is not going to happen. And while we were talking there, and while Pooh was telling you about Christmas, Allison was crawling in and out of the back of the chair and around up on top and underneath the chair and laying on the floor. All of those kinds of things. Those of you who have children know exactly what I'm talking about. And sometimes it's fun just to watch that kind of thing. Well, that was our Christmas, and I'll be right back. I'm going to give you some recipes for that turkey and dressing and the gravy. And so if you want to write it down, get pen and paper, because I guarantee you, folks, if you try these recipes, you're going to absolutely trouble, folks. Make sure you write this down, because this is my secret recipe for dressing turkey and gravy. And if you use this next Thanksgiving or next Christmas or whenever you want to cook a turkey, it doesn't matter. You can cook a turkey next week. And a lot of people will, probably, because some people have traditionally have ham or something else for Thanksgiving or Christmas instead of turkey. You can also do this with goose or chicken or anything else, but you have to reduce the time accordingly. Okay, and I'm talking about the cooking time. Okay, for a turkey, you need at least a 20-pound bird, but it should not be too big to fit in your roasting pan. You need a big roasting pan with high sides. You're not going to cover this turkey with anything. And the reason you want high sides on the roasting pan is because this turkey is going to make the beginnings of your gravy while it's cooking, and none of it is going to burn in the bottom of the pan, I guarantee you. So listen very carefully to me. You need between a 20 and a 23-pound turkey. And what you do is you make sure that it's thawed on the day that you're going to cook it, which means you may have to, if it's a frozen turkey, you may have to take it out of the freezer about 4 or 5 days in advance and put it in the refrigerator and let it thaw. If it's a fresh turkey, then you don't have to worry about that. But it's got to be completely thawed, if it was frozen, on the day you're ready to cook. And what you need to do is unwrap the turkey, clean out the cavities, take out all the heart, the liver, the gizzard, and the neck, and save those. But take the liver and package it up separately and put it in your freezer, because turkey liver or chicken liver is one of the main ingredients for authentic and the very best Italian spaghetti. So you want to save that liver, don't throw it away. But don't put the liver in your dressing or in your gravy unless you're a liver freak, because everything will taste like liver if you do. So take the neck, the gizzard, and the heart, and put them in a Ziploc bag and put them in the refrigerator, because you're going to need them the next day. Now, to cook the turkey the way I do it, you need to start fixing it the night before you're going to eat it. Okay? The next thing you need to do is wash the turkey really good, inside and out. And make sure that you pull up the legs and the wings and get all the yuckety stuff out of the creases that you normally don't see. And you might want to pluck any remaining feathers that might be left on the bird, or any of the quills that may still be sticking into the flesh. When you're done with that, set the turkey aside to dry for a little bit. If you've got a helper, like I do, you can have your helper be patting the turkey dry while you're getting all the rest of the things out to make the dressing. And what you need for the dressing is 2 12-ounce boxes of cornbread stuffing mix. This is just, you know, you can make your own cornbread stuffing mix if you want, but it's easier if you buy 2 big boxes, 12 ounces each, of Mrs. Cubbinson's. That's the one that I prefer over all others. Gives the very best flavor. It's called Mrs. Cubbinson's. If you don't have that, you can use something like a Safeway a generic brand cornbread stuffing mix, but it's got to be cornbread stuffing mix. Now, if you don't like cornbread, don't worry about it, because the stuffing is not going to taste like cornbread. It's going to be the best tasting thing you've ever had in your mouth, and it's not going to have anything to do with what you've ever associated with the way cornbread tastes. But that's what you need. You need 2 12-ounce boxes, and each box is going to have 2 6-ounce bags in it. And what you do is you get the biggest, giantest bowl you can find. In our case, we have a big stainless steel giant mixing bowl, and you put all that stuffing mix in that bowl. And by that time, you've got all the stuff out, all the vegetables. What you need is two 12-ounce boxes of stuffing mix, Mrs. Cubbinson's, if you can find it, If not, get a generic brand, but it has to be cornbread stuffing. You need one huge onion. Now, I mean a big onion, folks, a real big onion. And you need enough celery to equal the amount of onion once it's chopped. Forget about what it says on the box. The box says 2 cups of onion. Well, if you've got a big enough onion, you're going to have more than 2 cups, and that's okay. Don't worry about it. You're going to need 4 cubes of butter. You're going to need a bottle of Chardonnay wine. Now, listen to me carefully. You need a large onion, really large onion, and you need enough celery so that when the celery is chopped, it's about the same amount as the onion will be. You need 4 cubes of real butter. Don't ever use margarine or any kind of butter substitute. You need 4 cubes of real butter. That's a whole pound of butter, folks. You need a bottle of Chardonnay wine. A bottle of Chardonnay wine. And you need one can of chicken stock. Don't use the non-fat kind. Use the regular chicken stock. You need a container of mushrooms. One container of mushrooms. You also need one handful of parsley. And, ta-da, you need a pinch of cayenne pepper.
Cayenne pepper and dressing. Oh, my goodness.
Don't worry, folks. You won't even taste it. The reason you put it in is because cayenne pepper helps to bring out the flavor of everything else. You'll never even know it's there. All you need is a good-sized pinch to put in there. And you need some Mrs. Dash, the regular Mrs. Dash. And what you do is you put in those 2 boxes of... Here's how you make it. You put in the 2 boxes of cornbread stuffing mix, all 4 bags. Put them in there. Then you chop up your onion. Fine, just like regular chopped onion. Throw that in there. Chop up the celery. Throw that in there. The celery and onion has to be the same amount. So the amount of celery that you chop depends upon how much onion you come out with after you chop that one huge big onion. The box recipe will say you need 2 cups. And what I'm telling you is forget about the 2 cups. You just chop up one huge big onion and you make the celery equal. And make sure that you use the celery leaves. Use all of the celery leaves and the celery heart. The softest, leafiest part of the celery is what you use. That will give you the best flavor. Then you chop up your mushrooms. And Pooh and I do all of this together. We chop everything. She chops, I chop, we all chop. And throw your mushrooms in. Throw your handful of parsley in. Almost forgot it. Your pinch of cayenne pepper. Sprinkle it liberally with Mrs. Dash. Melt the 4 cubes of butter in the microwave. And then pour the butter over the top and mix the butter in thoroughly before you do anything else. Mix the butter in really thoroughly. Then you put in 2 cups of Chardonnay wine. 2 cups of Chardonnay wine. And pour that over. Mix it up real good, and then put in the 1 can of your regular chicken stock and mix that up real good. Your stuffing's ready. Cover it. Set it aside to sort of, mix together on its own, and it will do that for a little while. And the smell right then and there will just about drive you mad. You'll want to eat it before it's even cooked. Take the turkey and salt the cavities really good. Now, you've got to do this really good, and don't pinch the salt, folks. I mean, I'm talking about handfuls of salt. You're going to need at least 2 handfuls of salt for the abdominal cavity, and you're going to need at least a good handful of salt for the neck cavity. You've got to do this, because if you don't do it, you may have a colony of bad things that you don't want growing in there, and that's the reason that you salt the cavities of large birds because it takes a long time for it to heat all the way through to the middle, and it gets just warm enough for tremendous colonies of bad kinds of microbes to grow, and the salt prevents that from happening. So if you salt the cavities real good, you're not going to have any problems with any kind of bacteria growing or any kind of microbes growing in these cavities while you're cooking your turkey. And a lot of people get sick on Thanksgiving or Christmas after eating turkey or turkey dressing from cooks who don't salt the cavities. And they get diarrhea and all kinds of things like that. We don't want that to happen to you. So I'm telling you right now, make sure that you salt the cavities really good. And don't worry about using too much salt. Believe me, it's going to be perfect and you're going to love it. When that's done, you take your stuffing and stuff the neck cavity first and pin it up real good with skewers, and then stuff the abdominal cavity really good. And folks, some people tell you to stuff loosely and not to pack it in. I pack it in just as much stuffing as I could get into both of those cavities. I've never had a problem with it at all. And so you can do the same thing if you want to. And skewer the wings to the breast so that they're not flopping all over, and make sure that the legs are fastened. You can either tie them up with string, or you can use that little metal thing that comes with the turkeys nowadays that you buy that fastens the legs over that cavity. And once that's done, then you heap some more dressing into the cavity and make a little round ball of dressing right there between where the legs cross. Put a rack in your roasting pan. You've got to have a rack in your roasting pan that holds the turkey at least 2 inches off the bottom of the pan. You cannot put the turkey in the bottom of the pan, and you're going to know why in just a minute. You've got to have a rack, and the rack needs to hold the turkey about, an inch and a half to 2 inches off the bottom of the pan. And to put the turkey on the rack, and then take a whole bottle, folks. You see, you've got some left over from the first bottle of Chardonnay. Don't use that, because you need a whole bottle. Take another whole bottle of Chardonnay and pour it in the bottom of the roasting pan. Just pour it in the bottom of the roasting pan. And then take one can of chicken stock, put that in the bottom of the roasting pan, and then take and put the turkey, the whole roasting pan, turkey, everything, in the oven. Put it in the oven. Close the oven door. Set it on 200 degrees. 200 degrees. Now listen to me very carefully, folks, because this is what does it for you. When you cook meat at slow, low temperatures over a long period of time, and there's enough moisture there to keep it from drying out, you will have really tender, moist, and most beautifully cooked meat you've ever seen. So you're going to cook this turkey at exactly 200 degrees for 12 hours. So you want to time it. You want to time putting the turkey in the oven so that it comes out just in time at the right time that you need for it to come out in order to have your turkey dinner. And for us, we like to have the turkey out of the oven about 2 hours before we serve the dinner. That gives it time to cool, gives us time to take the stuffing out. And you're going to have, by the way, I forgot to tell you, you're going to have some stuffing left over. What you do is put that in a casserole dish and you cook that stuffing while you're the other things are getting ready before you're going to serve your meal. Now, remember, you have to put the turkey in the oven 12 hours before you want to take it out. So if you want to take your oven out at your turkey out of the oven at 12 noon, then you want to put it in the oven at 12 midnight. If you want to take it out at 11 in the morning, you want to put it in at 11 p.m. the night before. And you don't have to look at it. You don't ever, in fact, you don't ever want to open the oven door because it's only 200 degrees. You open that door once, and folks, you've lost all your heat. And so now you've got to cook it longer than 12 hours. So once you put it in and close that door and set it at 200, you leave that alone. Don't open that door. Don't look in that oven. And another thing that you do when you open the oven is you let all the moisture out. You don't want to do that. You want that moisture to stay in there because that's what makes the turkey moist and tender and just absolutely wonderful. And 12 hours later, don't open it until exactly 12 hours has passed. When you open that oven door, your turkey will be perfectly browned. All of the drippings from the turkey will have gone into the pan and combined with the wine and the chicken stock. And that will be the basis for your gravy. Okay? It's not all of your gravy, but I got to tell you, when you taste just that, your mouth is going to be watering. It's just absolutely delicious, but we're going to do some more things to it. So after 12 hours, you take your turkey out. You let it cool for just a little bit. Then you take the turkey on the rack out of the roasting pan and set it on a carving board. And as soon as it's cool for enough that you can take the stuffing out, immediately remove all the stuffing from all of the body cavities. You've got to do that. And put it in a bowl and cover it really good, and then put it somewhere where it will stay warm. And then you take the roasting pan, and you put it on top of the stove, covering two burners, and set it on a low heat just so that it simmers. And then you chop another whole container of mushrooms. You put that in there. You chop an equal amount of celery and onion, and you put those in there. And you put the neck, remember the neck and the gizzard and the heart from the turkey? You put those in a little pan, and you put some of the juice from the roasting pan in that pan, and along with another can of chicken broth, and you let that cook. You let it come to a boil, and then put it down on low and let it simmer covered for about an hour or an hour and a half. And then you take it out, put it on a cutting board, let it cool, and you take all the meat off the neck, and we give our bones to the dogs, but take all the meat off the neck, and then you cut that meat up really fine, and you cut up the gizzard really fine, and you cut up the heart really fine, and you put all of that back into your gravy. Then you go back to your turkey, and you look all around your turkey for all of the things that you're not going to eat, that you know you're not going to eat, and you cut that off the turkey, like the tail and some of the big pieces of skin, like the skin that covered the neck cavity, and you take the bone out of the tail, and then you chop all of that up and put it in your gravy, and you stir that and let it simmer. And I've got to tell you, folks, it's going to be the best gravy you've ever tasted in your entire life. You're going to have the best dressing you've ever tasted in your entire life. You're going to have the best turkey you've ever tasted in your entire life. And you don't have to spend a lot of time opening the door and basting it or covering it with tin foil or anything else. You do not have to cover this turkey. In fact, if you do cover it, it will not get brown. It's got to be in there for 12 hours at 200 degrees. And when you take it out after 12 hours, it will be perfectly browned. It will be perfectly done. It will be perfectly moist. And it will be so tender that the meat will literally fall right off the bones. And sometimes it's a little difficult to carve because while you're trying to carve off slices, the whole breast slides off the turkey. That's what kind of a wonderful meal you're going to have. The dressing is just absolutely delicious. In fact, I have talked myself into going and making a whole big plate of leftovers right after this broadcast because I am making myself hungry all over again. And that's okay with me because I love every wonderful mouthful of these kinds. And that's why I got into cooking it. When I was single and I lived in Hawaii, I used to know an awful lot of people who didn't have any relatives in Hawaii, like me. had no place to go on Thanksgiving. And so I used to invite all of those people over to my house, and I used to cook two big giant turkeys, and we would just feast all day. And they would bring salad and things like that. I would make the dressing, the gravy, the turkey, and they would bring wine and salad and potatoes and all of that kind of stuff, and we would just have the most wonderful Thanksgivings. And so now I do that for my family. I will return after this brief pause. Well, let's open the phones now and see what kind of a Christmas that you had. We had a wonderful Christmas here. Absolutely fabulous. It was the first year in a long time that it hasn't snowed, so we did not have a white Christmas. I think one morning there was, maybe it was Christmas morning, there was a little frost on the ground that the girls called snow, but it wasn't really snow, it was frost. The number's 520-333-4578. That's 520-333-4578. What kind of a Christmas did you have? Call us up and let us know. And, if you have a favorite recipe that you want to share with everybody for Christmas or Thanksgiving, now's the time to do it. 520-333-4578. We want to hear all about your Christmas. And, what you really enjoyed the most about it. And if you have a wonderful recipe that you'd like to share with the listening audience, we'd like to hear about that too. So give us a call right now at 520-333-4578. And while we're waiting for that, we'll just listen to this. The number is 520-333-4578. Phones are open. Well, I guess nobody besides us had a Christmas worth sharing. And no recipes that they want to share, that's for sure. I'm sure that many people had a wonderful Christmas, and I'm sure that a lot of them are traveling right now or may still be on their Christmas vacation or with relatives or whatever. So what we'll do for the rest of this evening, as soon as the top of the hour comes up, is we will finish the Dr. Wallach tape that we ran last week and only finished half of. So you still got another 45 minutes or so of that particular tape. For those of you who are interested in hearing Dr. Wallach's recommendations for your own personal health and how to improve it, by the way. I think you'll find that what he's got to say is of tremendous interest to everyone. And what I've learned from him is are things that I have never learned from anyone else. And by applying his advice, I have really improved my health quite a bit. I was pretty sick for a long time, folks. In fact, for a while I actually had some tumors growing on my chest just beneath my neck. And thanks to a lot of help from an awful lot of people, Ann and Paul and Gene and Michael and a whole lot of other people. I mean, there's a list that's so long I probably could take half the broadcast just reading off those names and thanking them. And they managed to get my immune system back in gear and eventually the tumors shrank and dropped right off. And I was so thankful for that. But I was still not healthy like I should have been, like I wanted to be, like we all should be. And so I began to listen to some of my friends who had been using and taking Dr. Wallach's recommended products for quite a long time, and my health has improved tremendously. In fact, it's what I would consider a miracle, to tell you the truth. The weather all over the country, especially in the north, from all the way from the West Coast, all the way across the central part of America and the Great Lakes, and the East Coast down to the top of some of the southern states, according to what I'm witnessing on the weather maps, you're having some pretty bad weather. And so I hope you're taking care of yourself and keeping warm and eating and drinking the things that you need to be eating and drinking, because that's the kind of weather that brings bad colds and flu and strep throat and sore throats and all kinds of things like that. It's not the cold that does it, folks. The cold, if you allow your body to get really cold, and especially if the core temperature drops, it really weakens your immune system. So you never catch cold by being cold. You never catch strep throat or pneumonia or flu or anything like that from being cold, but it allows the germs or the viruses, the microbes, to take hold in your body and begin to grow if you allow your body to get really cold, because then it lowers the strength of your immune system and it's not able to fight back like it should. So take care of yourself. Stay warm, folks. And make sure you eat and drink the things that you need to provide the energy that you need, especially if you're working out in that cold weather. If you got to go out in that cold weather and stay out there for quite a while, your body needs strength. Your body needs the proper nutrition. Your body needs the right vitamins. Your body needs plenty of protein. And this time of year, if you've got to be working out in real cold weather, you even need some fat. And a lot of people will tell you never to eat fat, but I'm here to tell you right now that I don't believe that. And Dr. Wallach doesn't believe it, and a lot of other people who have studied nutrition and know what happens to the body if you leave certain things out. You see, in my research, ladies and gentlemen, I've gone way beyond all of these things. I go way beyond what Dr. Wallach says in that I have gone back through history and watched when these particular diseases became prevalent in our society. And I'm going to tell you that back in the times when people ate natural food, they made their own flour, they made their own bread, they raised their own animals for meat, and they did all of those things, they did not have an awful lot of the diseases that strike us down today. They did not have additives. They did not have preservatives. They did not have chemicals added to their food. They didn't eat a lot of artificial things like margarine and what is this thing they've got out now, artificial grease? They ate natural food. And while their life expectancy, according to the statistics, was low, if you'll study what the people died from, ladies and gentlemen, and the reason that the statistics were low, they died from accidents. Most of the death figures, not from the diseases that we have today. Now, occasionally, a tremendous disease would strike and sweep through the population and would kill an awful lot of people. And we all know that is the bubonic plague, the great flu epidemics, and some of the smallpox and things like that. Those were caused by poor sanitation, not because of the food that they ate, because sanitation was bad. They were drinking water in which their sewage flowed and all kinds of other strange and unacceptable practices. The people who stayed clean and practiced good habits and drank clean water and ate natural foods lived up into their 80s and 90s, and yes, folks, even over 100, and yes, even 500 years ago, they were doing that. You're listening to WBCQ, Monticello, Maine, USA. I'm William Cooper, and this is the Hour of the Time. Don't go away, folks. We'll be right back with Dr. Wallach in just a few seconds. Good evening. You're on the air.
Oh, yes, Mr. Cooper.
Yes, sir.
Can I share with you a memory from Christmas past?
Well, certainly you can.
Plum pudding.
Oh, yes. It's been an awful lot of years.
Since I've had plum pudding or bread pudding or any kind of these traditional puddings that the people make on Christmas, or everybody in America, it's got a crush on
said, because I'm so oriented, I don't think people suit. Let me put it out. I don't think many people take the time to make those kinds of traditional dishes anymore. Well, I think there are still some days out of the year. I think I really, you know, cook everything. That's also the right way to talk about Thanksgiving or Christmas or two of those days. There may be some. I know that families congregate. Depending on the ethnic background, the ancestral origin of the family, I don't know that
We would have marzipan every once in a while.
Yeah. Well, explain to me, what is it? What is marzipan?
Oh, gosh, it's hard to explain.
Oh, is that white candy?
Yeah.
Oh, now I know what it is. Yes, and it's been a long time since I've had that.
Yeah, marzipan.
Yeah.
Mozart liked it.
Well, I didn't know Mozart personally, but but I've got a lot of his music. Yes, it's the Commando March, as a matter of fact.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's the popular name for it. That's not Barber's name for it, but that's what it's popularly called, the Commando's March.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I hope you had a nice Christmas, and say hi to the babies for me, and I wish you the very best in the coming year.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you for calling.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, I had one person who wanted to share his Christmas with us, and I thank him for that. So without further ado, here is Dr. Wallach, and if you need to call to get a packet of information so that we can get you started taking his, following his recommendations, call one of these two numbers. During the next hour, it's 1-888-403-2405. That's 1-888-403-2405 or 1-888-701-0502. That's 1-888-701-0502. And once we get your information, we'll get you off an information packet right away. And you're under no obligation to do anything. And if you don't want to become a preferred customer or an associate, then we'll be happy to sell you any of these products at the retail price, because that's that's what we'll have to do if you don't want to become a preferred customer or an associate. And we'll get them right out to you immediately. In fact, if you want to bypass the whole thing, just call this number tomorrow, and we'll tell you how to go about getting your health better real quick, ladies and gentlemen. If you like to save a lot of money, and that's why we've made this available to you, if you'd like to save a lot of money and not pay the retail price, then call one of these two numbers tonight. We'll get your information packed right out to you. Just follow the instructions and the personal letter that you will receive from me, and you'll be able to, you won't have to spend as much money to get your health better. That's why we did this, folks. You see, we could have just got on the air and announced that we have these things available and just sold them to you at a retail price, but knowing that we could get them for you a lot cheaper, I couldn't do that and would never do that. We've always tried to do the very best thing for our listening audience, and we will continue to do that. So once again, here's the numbers, 1-888-403-2405 or 1-888-701-0502. So, and I'll repeat those later in the broadcast. Here's Dr. Wallach, and it takes up right where we left off last week. And most of you have never heard all of this side of the tape, and so you need to listen very carefully.
And they looked specifically at psychotropic drugs, things that interfered with the mental function and the dexterity and the reasoning ability of doctors. They looked at speed, marijuana, cocaine, barbiturates, opium derivatives, fentanyl, things of that nature. And they found out that 52% of the licensed medical doctors in America use psychotropic drugs illegally on themselves each and every week. 52%. What that means is, if you go to a medical doctor for anything, don't be too excited about their degrees and their certificates and their licenses hanging on the wall. What you want to do very carefully is look at the pupils of their eyes and see if they're gorked out on something before you let them examine you, prescribe to you, or do any kind of procedure. One of my favorites was an anesthesiologist. He was actually a professor of anesthesiology at Stanford, up in, San Jose? Palo Alto. Okay, thank you. He was supposed to do the anesthesia. He's a professor now, full professor, 34 years old. The guy was brilliant, young man, brilliant. He's supposed to be doing the anesthesia for a liver transplant. The patient's in there on the table, prepped, ready to go, ready for the anesthesia. The liver is in the ice bucket, ready to go, and the liver from the donor was in there waiting to be put in the recipient. The surgeons are all scrubbed up. Their gloves are up waiting for the anesthesiologist, and they couldn't find him. So they had the head nurse run out in the hall and call his home. His wife said, "You left 2 hours ago." And it's only 15 minutes to the hospital. So he started paging him on his pager. No response. Well, just, again, accidentally, one of the guards in the hospital at Stanford hear the a beeper going off in this little one-holer in the hall. Door's locked. So the guard kicks the door open. And here's Dr. John Barry Dykes, 34 years old, professor of anesthesiology at Stanford Medical School, with a shoe off, dead between the toilet and the floor. He'd been giving himself an injection of fentanyl in between his toes. He was actually going to do the anesthesia. This guy who's supposed to be the ethical and moral leader of these students was going to be doing anesthesia for a liver transplant under the effects of fentanyl, and he happened to overdose himself, and he kills himself. John Barry Dykes, age 34 years of age, when he died. Last one, then we'll get on to the details of great diseases here. This one's local. You may have recognized this guy here, Dr. Michael A. Potler, 30-year-old pediatrician. He was just out of his residency and internship, 3 or 4 years. He's a troublemaker from the get-go in medical school. His nickname in the medical school was the social director, because he was the guy that got the drugs and the alcohol for the medical student parties. And there he is wearing Birkenstocks, a graduate medical doctor, does drugs, wearing Birkenstocks, so that should make you nervous. You know, you go into the exam room and the guy's dancing around in Birkenstocks, snapping his gloves, has needle tracks on his arms, and make you a little nervous, wouldn't it? Wouldn't me. Anyway, he kills himself in overdose of recreational drugs. Gives himself an intravenous injection and he kills himself. Now, because he's a medical doctor, they eulogize him on the front page of the San Diego Union Tribune. He saved the lives of children but lost his own. And in the article, it said he devoted his whole life to caring for children. Now, he was only out of his residency for 3 years. So unless he was a pedophile or a babysitter, that had to be a lie. Also, Dr. Michael A. Potler was a thief because the drugs he killed himself with, he stole from the hospital pharmacy. Thirdly, Dr. Michael A. Potler was malignant dumb. That's about as dumb as you can get because after 14 years of medical school and 3 years of private practice, he still could not read a syringe right and kills himself with an overdose. Now, would you want him working on your kids or grandkids? I wouldn't. First of all, you want to compare him. You want to compare him with a high school dropout. Can't read, can't write, can't do simple math, lives in a cardboard box, eats garbage. The only vehicle this poor soul will ever have is a grocery cart he steals from a neighborhood grocery store. Does drugs five times a day and lives forever. Goes on and on and on compared with Dr. Michael A. Potler. Here's one where you can give thanks to the Lord that, you know, he took him out of the loop for you. God works in mysterious ways sometimes. My favorite medical editorial is lining doc's pockets. If you go to your doctor, you want him to think you use a patient, not a cash cow. But two studies in this month's New England Journal of Medicine show that doctors are out to milk you dry. Now, you don't need to be a dairy farmer to figure out what that means. That's pretty straightforward. 10 months later, in the Reader's Digest, which to me is the sweetest little magazine that ever was, never says anything negative about any individual or any group, page 77, they say, can you trust your doctor? And they list 12 ways that doctors routinely scam money from their patients. I'm going to give you the worst one. You can go look up the other 11. The worst one, according to Reader's Digest, not Joel Wallach, is doctors get a kickback of $421 every time they refer you in for a CAT scan or an MRI. Now, according to Reader's Digest, not Joel Wallach, the average doctor in America gets $226,681 a year. That's almost $250,000 in CAT scan kickbacks. And you wonder why healthcare costs keep spiraling upward. That's just one procedure. Kind of exciting, isn't it? This one here is a little over 2 years old, January 1995. This is an obituary of a lady, 48 years old, young, died of breast cancer, according to the article. Grace Nasira, given radiation as a baby. I wanted to know what that meant. You get kind of excited about these things. And I read her obituary, did a little library research up in La Jolla, the medical school here in San Diego. And when she was 6 months old, she was a sickly child. With all the pediatric heroics of the day, they couldn't fix her, so they put her in the hospital and they took an x-ray machine and they shrank her thymus gland because they didn't know what else to do. I said, nobody in their right mind would do that because everybody knows your thymus gland is a major part of your immune system. It activates killer T cells, which protects you from hepatitis virus, Epstein-Barr virus, HIV virus, cancer. And so I went into the pediatric medical literature between 1945 and 1950, and it was common practice. According to the U.S. Department of Energy, more than 1 million American babies under the age of 1 year had their thymus gland shrunk between 1945 and 1950 with x-ray machines. And according to the U.S. Department of Energy, these kids have either already died of cancer, like Grace Nasira, or they're currently under treatment for cancer. It's projected they're going to die of cancer based on the amount of radiation they receive in their neck and chest to shrink their thymus gland. And I want you to remember that not a single foreign enemy has ever radiated in America. And this came from the profession who is famous for saying, now you have to trust me, my dear, I'm a doctor. You wonder what the pupils look like on the eyes of this surgeon in Grand Rapids, Michigan at the Butterworth Hospital when he took off the normal breast and left the cancerous breast on this woman. I guarantee you that he was gorked out on something. Because look at the date here, March 17th, 1995. What day is that? St. Patrick's Day. I guarantee you even a dyslexic surgeon wouldn't make that mistake. Now this fellow here, Willie King, has become the poster child for people who have been injured, infected, or killed in hospitals. He went into the University Community Hospital in Tampa, Florida to get his right leg amputated for gangrene because he had uncontrolled diabetes. And the bones were sticking out of the ends of his toes. The skin was flipping off. And his flesh smelled like rotten meat in a garbage can on a hot July night. And the surgeon promptly cut off his normal left leg. But they made it up to Willie a week later. They cut off his bad leg for nothing. And so he got two legs cut off for the price of one. A couple more and we'll get into the good stuff. Dr. Raymond Sattler, a neurosurgeon from Wilmington, North Carolina, had his license suspended for 30 days, according to this news article, because after exposing the patient's brain for surgery, ran out for 25 minutes because he got the munchies, went into the hospital lunchroom and had to go eat something. Now, I don't believe that's what happened because I've done a lot of surgery, and when you get hungry and have to go to the bathroom real bad, you don't tell the nurse, keep him warm for a half hour, I'll be back. You go faster, you know, you get the stitches farther apart, whatever you have to do to get done. And if it's a long, complicated procedure, you have the nurse call in somebody else to kind of carry on for you or excuse yourself for a few minutes. Well, I believe that Dr. Raymond Sattler is part of this 52% of the medical doctors who do drugs every week. And he was going through withdrawals. And he had to run into the bathroom and snort some cocaine or give himself an injection to get himself under control. And I based this opinion on this statement from the State Medical Board of North Carolina. They said, Dr. Raymond Sattler forgot the names of surgical equipment or instruments during the operation. He told his nurse to drill holes in the patient's head with a Black & Decker drill. We're talking about Sears home repair here. She didn't know what she was doing. Okay, doc, whatever you say. And if you've ever drilled a hole through a board or a piece of metal, you know you don't just barely go to the other side because there's burrs and things. And I imagine this gal made a smoothie out of this guy's brain trying to get those burrs out of his skull. And this doctor, Dr. Raymond Sattler, got his license suspended for 30 days because he turned the procedure over to a untrained person. Now, this last one, this is concept number one, the last one, has to do with the basic training that medical students should get before they become physicians. You'd like to believe that they get taught the very most basic of stuff, like what a live patient looks like, what a dead patient looks like. That should be basic. They should actually have courses entitled Life 101, Death 102, so that the general public has some confidence that they get taught this basic stuff. But when you see this kind of thing that I'm going to show you next, you just scratch your head and say, come on, guys. And I see about 300 to 400 of these a year as I crisscross this country lecturing. Morgue worker finds woman alive in body bag. This gal here, Mildred C. Clark, 86 years old, was found cold, stiff, and blue on her nursing home apartment floor. The house doctor claims he couldn't find a pulse or respiration. She's 86 years old. Let's just let her slip away quietly. We don't want to run up the bills, you know, for the survivors. We don't want to make her miserable in the last few moments of her life. So he declared her dead, threw her body in a meat wagon, sent her off to a small hospital in Albany, New York for her autopsy, because she died without any history of real illness, apparently. Died suddenly. Small hospitals, of course, don't have a full-time pathologist or a coroner there, so they have to call one. So the house doctor has to write a death certificate so they can put her in the freezer until they get there. I guarantee you, he didn't come out of his air-conditioned office 2 weeks behind in paperwork to go down to a stinking morgue to declare this woman dead, because after all, another doctor already said she's dead. So he just signs a death certificate, sends it down, and this morgue worker says, oh, here's a dead one, strips her naked, takes the pressure hose, blows the makeup off her face, the gunk off her body, puts her wet and naked into a body bag in the freezer for an hour and a half until the coroner and pathologist get there to do the autopsy. They wheel her out of the freezer, zip open the body bag, and Mildred C. Clark, age 86 years old, sits up. She says, thank God you found me. It was cold and dark in there, and I didn't know where I was. And even the morgue technician said he thought he heard breathing coming out of the freezer, but he was too scared to open it. Now, Mildred C. Clark had to be a tough old bird, let me tell you. If you don't believe it, get naked, hose yourself down, and get in the freezer with the ice cream for an hour and a half and see how well you do. Now, the last moral of this story is concept number one, again, is whatever you do, whenever a doctor says, here's our options, never say, doc, whatever you say, you're the doctor. What you want to do when a doctor says, here's our options, what you want to do is say, look, I want copies of all these records and tests, I want copies of the x-rays, and go visit three other doctors in three other hospitals. You want to talk to 12 of their living patients that had gone through this procedure. Talk to them, see if you really want to do this. I mean, you do this for your driveway and your roof and your fence and your yard and all that kind of stuff. Why not for your own physical body? That's concept number one. Now that you've avoided the landmines, you're in a good position to do all the positive things that you need to do to go on to live to be over 100. Basically, what you want to do is take all 90 essential nutrients, 60, that's 60 minerals, 16 vitamins, 12 essential amino acids, and 3 essential fatty acids. And they're called essential nutrients for two reasons. Number one, your body cannot manufacture them. You must consume these every day, either as food or as supplements. Number two, if any one of these 90 essential nutrients is missing for a couple of months, a couple of years, you get on the average 10 deficiency diseases. 10 deficiency diseases times 90 essential nutrients has 900 diseases that you can potentially prevent just simply by supplementing properly. You have everything to gain, nothing to lose by supplementing properly. Well, the medical profession, of course, has this malignant dumb belief that you can get everything you need from your four food groups. My favorite article of all time in the press was April 6, 1992, 5 years ago now. Time flies when you're having fun. Time magazine, cover article, The Real Power of Vitamins. New research shows it may help fight cancer, heart disease, and the ravages of aging. 6 positive pages. If you haven't read it, I'd urge you to go to a public library, school library, dig it out and read it. There's only one negative sentence, and as you might guess, it was offered by a medical doctor who was actually contacted by the writer of the article, said, what do you think about vitamins and minerals and trace minerals as supplements for human nutrition? Here's what he said, quote, popping vitamins doesn't do you any good, sniffs Dr. Victor Herbert, a professor of medicine at New York City's Mount Sinai Medical School. We get all the vitamins we need in our diets, and taking supplements just gives you expensive urine, unquote. Now, Missouri translation of that is, you're just peeing away your money. might as well wad up your dollars, throw them in the toilet, and flush them away. You can get everything you need from your four food groups, is what he's trying to say. Well, I'd rather pee out 50 cents or a dollar a day worth of excess vitamins and minerals. That's cheap insurance. Think about it. How much money you spend for coffee or soft drinks or newspapers and that kind of stuff every day? 50 cents to a dollar a day to maintain and repair your body. And it's kind of fascinating that most people don't do it. Just remember, when you pay that doctor out of your own pocket or indirectly through insurance or indirectly through taxes, Medicare, Medicaid, not a single penny of that goes to better understand, manage, treat, prevent, or cure catastrophic diseases in kids, breast cancer in women, prostate cancer in men. It pays the doctor's mortgage, the doctor's Mercedes payment, and tuition for his kids to go to medical school, or worse yet, Yale Law School. That's all we need is a bunch more Yale lawyers walking around. Now, a lot of people ask me, why did you call your original tape Dead Doctors Don't Lie? Why do you call your lecture series Dead Doctors Don't Lie? Well, that's because I believe for a long time, because I'd done medical research for over 20 years in large medical research institutes, medical schools, the various laboratories, and I always had a belief in the medical system, but I was very disappointed when I learned that doctors don't know the most about health and longevity. Doctors don't know the most about disease. They do know about procedures, you know, how to fix your bones when you break them, and that sort of thing, how to do a CAT scan. And so I began to look in the medical journals in the medical school library here in San Diego, and sure enough, the first article ever published on health and longevity of American doctors was published in JAMA on June 15, 1895, a little over 100 years ago. They said at that time, doctors lived to be 54.6. I redid the study 97 years later using the same obituary techniques that they did in JAMA. This was January 20th, 1993, in that particular issue of JAMA. And it turned out the doctors lived to be 57.6. I rounded up to 58 to give them the benefit of the doubt. And doctors just went berserk when I said that. I mean, this was the most outrageous thing I've ever heard. My principle is, my premise is, that doctors don't live as long as the average couch potato in America. And I purposely put that figure out there, 58, to try and challenge people. Well, doctors immediately looked at all the insurance actuarial charts. They got 250,000 dead doctors. They said, your group's too small. So they looked at 250,000 dead doctors and they say, doctors don't live to be 58. They died 62. They still don't live to be 75.5 like the average couch potato. We actually re-ran this again using the entire obituary history for 1996. And for the entire 1996, of all the doctors dying in 1996, with all the medical treatments and drugs and procedures and everything, and transplants, doctors in that study lived to be 70, still 5.5 years short of the average couch potato in America. So they still have never proven that doctors live as long as everybody else, and that's why dead doctors don't lie. Doctors kill each other in surgery just like they do everybody else. Here's one of my favorites. Dr. Ian Monroe, 73 years old, was the editor of Lancet, the top British medical journal, the top international medical journal. It's very famous. Every newspaper in America quotes articles out of Lancet. USA Today, New York Times, San Diego Union Tribune. The cause of death was complications of surgery, which is just a politically correct way of saying the surgeon killed him. The editor of Lancet. And then, of course, when you eliminate fast cars and suicides and overdoses of drugs and airplane accidents and so forth, doctors die of nutritional deficiency diseases just like everybody else. I brought you just two or so of my favorites. Dr. Stuart Cartwright, age 38, was a local physician here in San Diego, died at age 38 of a ruptured coronary aneurysm. This guy was a good-looking kid. Could have been a movie actor. I'm sure he married the prom queen. Southern California probably had a Mercedes convertible, white leather interior, and all the bells and whistles. Probably never repaid a student loan, all the things that medical students are famous for. And drops dead of a ruptured coronary artery aneurysm in his heart. Something a turkey wouldn't die from. We learned in 1957 from a turkey study where they took 250,000 turkeys and they put them on a complete turkey pellet trying to get them to finish for market within a few days or a week or so of each other. And in the first 13 weeks, fully half of them, 125,000 of them died. Farmers were out there every morning. They picked them up every morning by the bushel basketful, took them to the state diagnostic lab to see what they died from. When they opened them up, every one of them had died of a ruptured aortic aneurysm. And one of the clever pathologists says, that's got to be due to a copper deficiency because copper is required to manufacture the elastic fibers of arteries and skin and other tissues. And the mechanism of an aneurysm is identical to the mechanism of a balloon on a weakened wall of a tire. You know when you hit a chuck hole with your tire and you break the cords, the internal pressure blows the balloon. You overload that tire with weight or heat it up on a highway, it blows out. Same way with an aneurysm. When you have a copper deficiency, you get a breakdown of the elastic fibers in that artery, the internal pressure, even normal blood pressure will blow a balloon in that artery, and a balloon in an artery is called an aneurysm. And of course, if it's in a strategic place like the brain, carotid artery, the coronary arteries, the large arteries, the aorta, pulmonary artery, renal arteries, they blow out, you die suddenly, just like you've been shot. Well, they got excited about this. They doubled the amount of copper in these pellets. The next year, they tried to raise 500,000 turkeys, and they did not lose a single one from a ruptured aneurysm. They went from a 50% loss to a 0% loss just by adding a little bit of copper to those pellets. So they said, well, maybe the same thing is true for humans. And in 1958, they started looking at copper deficiency in various species of animals and humans, and here's what they found out. The very first symptom of copper deficiency in human beings is white, gray, and silver hair. Copper is required as a cofactor to manufacture hair pigment. Doesn't matter if it's blonde, red, brown, or black hair. And I see a lot of copper deficiency in this room. I can almost tell you which people, men and women, who have colored their hair, get pretty good at that, as being a physician. And you don't want to be like a medical doctor and just treat the symptoms. If you're just coloring your hair, you're treating the symptoms. You need to do the basic thing of take some colloidal copper. And if you don't, what's going to happen is you get a breakdown of the elastic fibers in your skin, and you start getting crow's feet around the corners of your eyes and your mouth. Parts of your anatomy begin to sag, and you know you're in trouble when your doctor tells you, look, I've got a golf buddy down the hall who's a plastic surgeon. For $10,000, he'll make you look 20 years younger. But you don't need a facelift, a booby lift, a tummy tuck, or a derriere lift. All you need is some colloidal copper, and everything will come back up just like you have a hydraulic jack under it. It'll just come right back up.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to receive a packet of information on Dr. Wallach and his recommendations on how you can improve your own personal health, call 1-888-403-2405. That's 1-888-403-2405 or 1-888-701-0502. That's 1-888-701-0502. Call now.
Elastic fibers tighten right up. People say, Francine, did you get a facelift? You look great. You look like you're 20 years younger. Now, if you don't take some action at that point, the next thing that happens is you get a breakdown of the elastic fibers in large veins of your legs, and you get varicose veins. If you don't take action at that point, you get a breakdown of the elastic fibers in large veins of your exhaust pipe, and you get hemorrhoids. So if you have hemorrhoids, varicose veins, things that sag, wrinkles, white, gray, or silver hair, the odds are you have aneurysms developing in you somewhere. And you don't want to, of course, die suddenly of a ruptured aneurysm when your body's been warning you for 10, 20, 30 years. Just remember, you people don't die suddenly of an aneurysm. It may be you drop and die. Think about old Albert Einstein. He died of a ruptured aortic aneurysm at 68 years of age. What color was his hair? He was famous for wild white hair, wasn't he? Now, you'd like to think that people who win the Nobel Prize in medicine would at least live to be 75.5, but they live to be 58 just like other doctors. And, of course, that's because they are trained and they believe and they practice. You can get everything you need from your four food groups. Doesn't matter if they win the Nobel Prize or not. This guy here, Dr. George Kohler, was the youngest person ever to win the Nobel Prize in medicine in history. 37 years old, wins the Nobel Prize in medicine. And he won the Nobel Prize in medicine for studying monoclonal antibodies, which are antibodies trained to attack cancer cells. If they ever get this really working, it'll be great because they won't have to use chemotherapy anymore, which kills more people than it saves. 11 years after winning the Nobel Prize in medicine, Dr. George Kohler, now 48, drops dead of a cardiomyopathy heart attack because he believed practice, you can get everything you need from your four food groups. Didn't take any selenium, died of a cardiomyopathy heart attack. Now, I have to tell you why athletes are early warning system. Couch potatoes, by definition, are people who go to extraordinary efforts not to sweat. Right? They make every human effort not to sweat. They're changing the TV channels. Honey, bring in the popcorn. I'm changing the channels. Son, bring me the TV guide. I'm changing the channels. By contrast, athletes have the attitude, no pain, no gain. And they're out there sweating and working away, power training, strength training, running, and they sweat. Athletes, no matter age, they sweat more in 5 years than couch potatoes do in 70 years. And when you sweat, you don't just sweat out potassium and Gatorade. You sweat out all 60 essential minerals. If you sweat out all of your selenium and don't replace it by supplementation, you're at high risk of getting a cardiomyopathy heart attack. If you sweat out all of your copper and don't replace it by supplementation, you're at high risk of developing an aneurysm and dying suddenly of a ruptured aneurysm. If you sweat out all of your chromium and vanadium and don't replace it by supplementation, you're at high risk of getting diabetes. And if you sweat out all of your calcium and magnesium and boron and zinc and sulfur and other minerals that are required for cartilage, ligaments, tendons, connective tissue, bone, you're going to get a joint and bone injury. What is the biggest single cause of an athlete's career being ended early? Joint and bone problems, right? And that's because they sweat out all the basic minerals that they need to maintain those parts of their body, and they don't supplement with them because doctors tell them that they can get everything they need by eating their four food groups. Well, what are the early warning systems for mineral deficiencies. We already told you about white, gray, or silver hair for a copper deficiency. Liver spots or age spots on the back of your hand, side of your face, or neck. These things are caused by a selenium deficiency. And you know, again, about selenium deficiency. Then, of course, you have toe cramps, leg cramps. So you can have hypertension. These things are all caused by a deficiency of calcium. And if you're an athlete at age 25 or 15 and you get a leg cramp, that's a calcium deficiency, your body's telling you, if you don't stop drinking those Pepsis and start supplementing with some calcium, by the time you're 40, 50, 60 years old, you're going to have arthritis and osteoporosis. But most people say, well, I got to get this high-priced trainer. I need somebody who can give me the massage therapy because I have a cramp. And they don't go and take their supplements. Now, lastly, is a behavior called pica and cribbing. Pica and cribbing. Farmers know about pica and cribbing. This is where animals eat non-food items. Dirt, rock, sand, wire, nails, shingles off the roof. They'll eat paint. They'll eat deer bones. If you see a cow eating deer bones, you know they're minerally deficient. Even a farmer with a fourth grade education knows they're minerally deficient. We'll give the animals minerals to prevent from having to rebuild the fence and prevent having large veterinary bills. Little kids react the same way. I'm sure you've seen little kids who use a plastic shovel or a little spoon and they're eating dirt out of the garden or maybe out of the house plants, maybe on the beach or the play box at school. And if you live in one of these newfangled houses and apartments that have everything artificial, man-made rugs wall-to-wall, maybe the tile, this man-made stuff, nothing organic in the house. These are kids that will watch the Disney Channel, and they'll put the kitty litter box between their knees, and they'll sit there eating the Tootsie Rolls because that's the only organic thing in the house. Not because it tastes good, because they're seeking. They have this pica and cribbing. Grandfather tends to be very tolerant and says, look, kid, if you got to do this, go over in the corner and do it. I don't want to have to watch. Mom and grandmom don't like that. They pick up this kitty litter box, put it on the kitchen counter, contaminate everybody in the household with worms, and they still haven't satisfied the kids' need for minerals, and they immediately go over and start eating the caulking from around the windows and the lead paint, not because it tastes good, but because it's convenient. Pregnant women are legendary for having pica and cribbing, usually at 2 o'clock in the morning. They want pickles and ice cream, curly French fries, hot and spicy foods. That's because the embryo is taking minerals from the mother, and if they don't supplement with minerals faster than the embryo is taking it from them, they get pica and cribbing and have these crazy cravings. Some of them go out in the middle of the night and eat clay in the full moon. Then, of course, non-pregnant women and adult men also get pica and cribbing. Here's where the snack food industry has really caught on. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says 95% of all Americans are deficient in minerals. So you figure that 95% of Americans are going to show mineral deficiency symptoms, including pica and cribbing. The snack food industry has spent billions of dollars over the last 10, 12 years convincing you that this behavior of eating non-food items is not called pica and cribbing, because you could go look it up in a dictionary. It'll say a mineral deficiency. They've convinced you that cravings and the binge eating habits and behaviors are called what? The munchies. Now, when you get the munchies, you're taught to eat their chips and their dips and their various snacks and pretzels and popcorn and so forth, their chocolate and Reese's peanut butter cups and curly French fries, and that's why Americans are overweight, basically because we're minerally deficient. Again, we need 90 essential nutrients, 16 minerals, 16 vitamins, 12 essential amino acids, 3 essential fatty acids. And fortunately, over the thousands of years that human beings have been around, we haven't had to think much about this, because our food plants, our grains, vegetables, fruits, and nuts take carbon dioxide out of the air and manufacture long carbon chains, many of which are vitamins, amino acids, and fatty acids. And this is where this medical caca came from, that you can get everything you need from your four food groups. Because they say, well, plants, grains, fruits, vegetables, nuts can manufacture vitamins, amino acids, and fatty acids. But we've tried this experiment for 200 years. Americans have eaten better than anybody else in the world. We've had the best quality food in the world over anybody else. And yet, we only live to be 75.5. We don't set any health and longevity records. So if you want to live to be over 100, can't get it from eating your four food groups. You can live to be 75.5. You may live 10 years older, 10 years younger, but on the average, 75.5. So if you want to live to be over 100, you do have to supplement with vitamins, amino acids, and fatty acids. Now, minerals are a different story. Plants cannot manufacture minerals the way that they can manufacture vitamins and amino acids and fatty acids. Plants cannot manufacture minerals. You have to remember that. Also, minerals never occurred in a uniform blanket around the crust of the earth. Minerals occur in veins, kind of like chocolate ripple ice cream. For 100 years, American farmers, and we did on our farm when I was a kid 50 years ago, we've used a simple fertilizer known as NPK, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, because for $25 an acre when I was a kid, $120 an acre today, NPK gives you the maximum yield in terms of tons and bushels per acre of ground. Nobody pays a farmer any kind of cash incentive or gives them a tax break to make sure you get all 60 essential minerals. That's your job. That's your job. They grow tons and bushels for domestic sale and for export. It only takes 5 to 10 years for crops to deplete, extract, or mine the minerals out of farmlands or rain soils. And we've been using NPK for 100 years. So you don't need to be a rocket scientist to figure out that over 90 years at least, we've been deficient in our soils in America. And as a result, our food is deficient. As a result, we spent $1.2 trillion for health care last year. If the government were just to give everybody vitamins and minerals and trace minerals, it would cut our cost of health care from $1.2 trillion to $200 billion. It would cut the health care by almost 90%. One of the things I want you to collect when you leave here tonight is a summary of U.S. Senate Document 264. U.S. Senate Document 264 says there's no longer any nutritional minerals left in our farm and rain soils, and as a result, the crops, the grains, fruits, vegetables, and nuts that are grown there are minerally deficient, and as a result, the animals and people who eat these minerally deficient crops get mineral deficiency diseases, and the only way to prevent and cure them is with mineral supplements. Now, to me, the scary thing about U.S. Senate Document 264 is that it was written and published by the U.S. Senate in 1936. 61 years ago, we knew this. This is when we began to put vitamins and minerals and trace minerals into animal feeds to make up the difference. Unfortunately for human beings, we got wonder drugs. We got sulfa drugs in 36. We got penicillin in 38. We got cortisone in 42. And everybody was led to believe if you just give medical research enough money, and if you faithfully watch Dr. Marcus Welby, MD, every week, they'll find a wonder drug to fix everything. We don't believe that anymore. That's why you're here tonight. Remember, it's 1936. Let's look at the most common mineral in the human body, in the animal body. 85% of the total mineral in your body is calcium. There's 147 different diseases you can get from a calcium deficiency. We're just going to quickly go over the top 10 when it comes to number of people affected and the amount of money involved. Let's look at osteoporosis, the number 10 killer of adults in the United States. Remember, 75% of those over age 65 who fracture a hip or a major leg bone don't live 90 days. Also, it's the most horrible disease when it comes to human misery and dollars expended. Osteoporosis, think of the special vans and the lift gates and the ramps and the elevators, the special plumbing in homes and public buildings, special parking places, wheelchairs and walkers and canes. Think of the beds and the chairs that are little electric motors that lift you up when you can't stand up by yourself. Physical therapists, joint replacement surgeries, pharmaceuticals, doctor's visits. We're talking billions and billions of dollars for nothing more than a calcium deficiency disease. Now, as horrible as a disease as osteoporosis is in human beings, we don't have osteoporosis in animals because we don't have Blue Cross Blue Shield, major medical hospitalization, Medicare and Medicaid to pay for nonsensical surgical treatments for mineral deficiency. We've learned that by putting animals who are weaned off their mother's milk on 10 cents worth of calcium as soon as they're weaned, they won't get arthritis and osteoporosis. It's amazing how that works. Receding gums. Dentists and dental hygienists will tell you to floss and brush after every meal. If you believe that works, I have some oceanfront property in Montana to sell you. If you have receding gums, periodontitis, gingivitis, pyorrhea, loose teeth, bridges and plates, you actually have osteoporosis of the facial bones and the jaw bones. We don't get receding gums in animals, even though they don't floss or brush. That's because we've taken care of the osteoporosis problem in animals. Arthritis. 85% of all arthritis is called wear and tear arthritis. Osteoarthritis, degenerative arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis. These things are nothing more than osteoporosis of the joint ends of the bones. Hypertension, high blood pressure, as you've learned, has nothing to do with salt or salt restriction. 85% of hypertension not related to kidney disease, which is most of them, not related to kidney disease, is in fact a calcium deficiency. Insomnia is not a deficiency of sleeping pills, Halcyon or barbiturates, it's a deficiency of calcium. Kidney stones, bone spurs, heel spurs, and calcium deposits. Again, the medical profession has a malignant, dumb belief that these things are due to too much calcium in your diet. Tell you to give up calcium. When in fact, you only get kidney stones, bone spurs, heel spurs, and calcium deposits when you have raging osteoporosis. You actually need more calcium, more magnesium, not less. Cramps and twitches. Cramps and twitches. Raise your hand. How many of you have ever had a toe cramp, foot cramp, leg cramp in your life? Sure. That's the first symptom of a calcium deficiency that most people recognize. So if you've ever had that sometime in your life, you've had a calcium deficiency. Then you have PMS, the University of California, San Diego, 8 years ago now, came out and said that 85% of the emotional and physical stuff of PMS can be relieved, eliminated, and cured. They use the cure word by taking 3 times the RDA of calcium. Low back pain has nothing to do with disc problems. I know you've heard of people, maybe even yourself, have had a disc surgery for back pain. And after the surgery, you still had the pain, maybe even worse, because back pain is not caused by disc problems. If you have a disc problem, you can have numbness and tingling, maybe even paralysis if it's very severe, but disc problems do not cause pain. If you have low back pain, the odds are you have cramps and spasms of large muscle groups inside and outside your lower back. These can subluxate or hook a line in your vertebrae and be uncomfortable, cause a lot of pain. You can also have bone spurs, calcium deposits, arthritis, osteoporosis. These are the things that cause low back pain. Now, you're educated. You're never going to say, Doc, whatever you say, you're the doctor, because you've gone through this lecture tonight. And unfortunately, most Americans have not heard this lecture yet. And as a result, they will spend between $25,000 and $250,000 and voluntarily undergo 5 to 10 surgical procedures for nothing more than the top 10 calcium deficiency diseases. In any other industry, that would be fraud. They'd be shut down. Something you can fix for 25 cents and you walk out with a $5,000 bill, you'd be kicked off. You'd want to talk to the manager. You'd want your money back. You'd call the Better Business Bureau. You'd call the state attorney general, and you'd complain. Class action suit. It'd be a big mess. But in the medical profession, everybody just runs to the government and say, we need more money to pay for it. Kind of fascinating. Okay, diabetes, blindness of all kinds, kidney failure, kidney transplant, kidney dialysis, contributes to numbers of cardiovascular disease, number one killer, amputations of toes, feet, and legs. If you let them amputate a toe, foot, or leg, actually, you can actually save your toes, feet, and legs. It takes 4 to 6 months of intensive work, but you can do it. But if you allow them to amputate a toe, foot, or leg, you do want to, of course, put a tag on it so they get the right one. Now, your doctor, when he diagnoses a new diabetic in his office, he gets very excited. And he'll drop to his knees and give thanks to the Lord. And then he'll jump up and call his real estate agent, because he knows over 20, 30, 40 years, if you're a diabetic, you're going to go through all these problems, blindness, kidney failure, cardiovascular disease, and the need for amputations. And as a result, you're worth to him $250,000 to $500,000. $250,000 to $500,000, just like adding another cow to the dairy herd. Now, to me, this is criminal, because we learned in 1957 in animals that we could prevent and cure adult onset diabetes with two trace minerals, chromium and vanadium. Just 12 years ago, 1985, the medical school at the University of Vancouver, British Columbia, up in Canada, came out and said that trace mineral vanadium alone could replace insulin in adult onset diabetics. Science Diet dog food has 40 minerals in it. Always has chromium, vanadium, lithium, and selenium. Ralston Purina laboratory rat pellets has 28 minerals. Always contains chromium, vanadium, lithium, and selenium. I'll give anybody in this room a crisp new $100 bill if you can find me a human infant formula off the shelf of a grocery store that has more than 12 minerals in it. None of them can contain chromium, vanadium, or lithium. Only one prosoybean Infamil, I believe, has 12 because they put in the selenium. The rest of them don't. They have 11, 10, 9, or 8 minerals. Our dogs get 40 minerals, our rats get 28, and our kids get 12 or less. You don't have to be a research scientist to realize why our kids are now getting all these horrible diseases that used to occur in people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s. All these diseases that doctors are wondering, is this genetic? These kids shouldn't have this till they're 60. Well, that's because they couldn't get it out of their little can of stuff. If it's not in the can, they don't get it. There's three types of minerals that you have to concern yourself with. And I talk about minerals rather than vitamins because two-thirds of the essential nutrients, 60 out of the 90, are minerals. Everybody knows everything there is to know about vitamins, and so we're talking about minerals today. First of all, there's metallic minerals. These are things like oyster shell, eggshell, limestone, coral calcium, seabed minerals, clays of various types. Tums is a popular one with doctors. Lactates, gluconates, citrates, oxides, sulfates, carbonates. These are nothing but ground up rocks. Animals and human beings are only able to get 8 to 12% of these minerals. We're not designed to eat ground up rocks as a source of minerals. When you hit 40 or 50 years of age, have you ever wondered why people suddenly fall apart when they hit the big 5-0? People dread turning 50 for that reason. The back goes, their teeth get loose, whatever hair you got left is gray. No interest in sex. You know, they just kind of fall apart. That's because your ability to absorb these elemental minerals drops precipitously to 3 to 5%. Now, about 4 years ago in Grand Rapids, Michigan, a guy jumps up in the back of the room and says, "Hey, Doc, now I know what I see in my porta-potty business." I said, "What on earth do you see in your porta-potty business?" He says, "Well, when we clean those things out and disinfect them to reuse them, we find hundreds and hundreds of vitamin pills that come through people." I said, "Come on now, how do you know they're vitamin pills? They could be anything." He says, "Oh, that's easy, Doc. On the coating, they say Theragram M, one a day, Centrum, and Centrum Silver." Now, a lot of my patients say, "Look, Doc, I've been taking 2,000 milligrams of calcium every day for 20 years because I knew it was good for me, yet I still have hypertension, insomnia, loose teeth, receding gums, low back problems, bone spurs, kidney stones, arthritis, osteoporosis, all the stuff you say you shouldn't have. And I've been taking 2,000 milligrams of calcium every day. And so what kind do you take? I say, well, I take calcium gluconate, calcium citrate, calcium lactate, oyster shell, eggshell. I take things like Tums. I say, well, there's your problem. If you take a 1,000 milligram calcium lactate tablet, for example, you're not getting 1,000 milligrams of calcium because 86% or 860 milligrams is lactose or milk sugar. Only 14% or 140 milligrams is metallic or elemental calcium. And let's use 10% for usability factors, a fair number, plus it's easy math. 10% of 140 milligrams is 14. So if you take two of those calcium lactate tablets, 1,000 milligrams, you're not getting 2,000 milligrams of calcium. You're getting 2 times 14 or 28 milligrams. You have 2,000 milligrams of usable calcium from a 1,000 milligram calcium lactate tablet. You have to take 30 of those with each meal, almost a full 100-tablet bottle of these calcium lactate tablets a day. And, of course, if $5 a bottle, the cheapest ones, you're looking at $150 a month just for calcium. You got 59 more minerals to go, 16 vitamins, 12 essential amino acids, 3 essential fatty acids, so this is not an economical way to get your nutrients as elemental minerals. Also, if you took in 90 tablets of anything a day, you're going to develop what we call BNF disease. BNF disease stands for belching and farting. You're going to sound like an elephant out in the woods with a horrible gastrointestinal problem. And, of course, you know you have BNF disease when your spouse has to throw a canary in the bathroom to see if it's safe to go in there. Now, during the 60s, the animal industry came up with what we call chelated minerals. That's because farmers are not dumb enough to put a dollar in an animal's mouth and have 99 cents come out in the manure. And so we learned that by adding amino acids, proteins, or enzymes to the elemental mineral, it increases the absorbability tenfold from 3 to 5% to 40%. And everybody got excited about chelated minerals during the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And if you look at the good multivitamin mineral tablets today, you will see a mixture of elemental and chelated minerals. But the way that animals and people are designed to consume and absorb minerals is in the plant-derived colloidal mineral form. We're not designed to eat ground-up rocks. Nobody can show you where humans or animals are designed to eat ground-up rocks. We're designed to get our minerals by eating plants, grains, vegetables, fruits, and nuts. And as a result, plant-derived colloidal minerals are 98% absorbable, 2.5 times more absorbable than chelated, 10 times or more absorbable than the elemental or metallic minerals. Plant-derived colloidal minerals are liquid. They're very small particle size. They're 7,000 times smaller than a red blood cell. This is the way they're stored in your cells and are moved around in plant vascular systems and human vascular systems in the liquid plant-derived colloidal form. They're negatively charged. I don't know all of the physics and the chemistry. It's one of the basic features of a colloidal mineral is negatively charged. These three factors together give you the 98% absorbability. Now, the way it's supposed to be is our food plants, our grains, vegetables, fruits, and nuts take the elemental or metallic minerals out of the soil, convert them to colloidal minerals for their own use, for their own metabolism and biochemistry, and then animals and people eat these plants that are enriched with minerals. That's how we're designed to get our minerals. Unfortunately, we have several problems here. Number one, U.S. Senate Document 264 in 1936 says there's no longer any nutritional minerals left in our farm and range soils. For 100 years, we've used a simple fertilizer known as NPK. We put in 3 nutrients into the soil when we need 60 minerals. We put those 3 nutrients in the soil for maximum yields per ton and bushel per acre. Then, of course, we have to understand that plants cannot manufacture minerals. If they're not in the soil, they're not in the plants. Plants only have minerals in them if they're in the soil. Plants cannot manufacture minerals. Fourthly, minerals do not occur in a uniform blanket around the crust of the earth. Minerals occur in veins, kind of like chocolate ripple ice cream. Also, I guess perhaps the biggest thing that has made America the most minerally deficient country in the world is that whenever somebody would find a nifty little article in the newspaper or magazine on a mineral or a vitamin, they'd take it to the doctor, and the doctor would poo-poo and say, you don't want to spend money for vitamins and minerals. You can get everything you need from your 4 food groups. And for 50 years, physicians have been taking away the interest from the general public by making fools of them, making them feel foolish. You can get everything you need. Why would you waste your money on those quacks? If you need a heart transplant for $750,000, I'll do it. Why take a mineral that can prevent it? Well, the last question you have to ask yourself is, what about those cultures that were written up in the National Geographic, January of 1973? Those 10 cultures that lived to be 120, 140, are they all genetically related? And the answer is no. They included certain tribes of Tibetans from the Himalayan Mountains, the Hunzas from eastern Pakistan and the Karakorum Mountains, the Russian Georgians, the Azerbaijanis, Abkhazians, Turkestanis, and Armenians from the Caucasus Mountains in western Russia, the Vilcabamba Indians, from the Andes of Ecuador, my favorites. I just love the name, the Titicacas. And they picked places accidentally. Certainly they weren't knowledgeable of this. Just out of the throw of the dice, they picked places that had 60 to 72 minerals in the parent rock of the mountains they chose to live in. There's dozens and dozens of cultures in the world who live at the same elevation in mountains, but they only have 3 or 5 or 10 or 12 minerals in the parent rocks they live in, and so they only live to be 75.5 like us. So that's the number one thing, 60 to 72 minerals in the parent rocks they live in. Secondly, they all picked places that had less than 2 inches of precipitation a year, no snow, no rain to speak of, and as a result, they had to pick places that were within easy reach of permanent water. They all picked places that were within 50 miles of glaciers, and they all built aqueducts to carry glacial water to the valleys they live in. Now, the water that comes out from underneath of glaciers is not clear, like Perrier or Evian water, or Elite, or whatever these natural spring waters are. The water that comes out from underneath of glaciers is cloudy. It has a lot of minerals suspended in it. It's called glacial milk, because it looks like milk. It's either white or grayish blue, because it has a lot of minerals suspended in it. As these glaciers move up and down the mountains during the various parts of the season, they grind up literally tens of thousands of tons of these rocks, and this rock dust or rock flour comes out in this glacial milk. Now, you boil away a quart of glacial milk, you get 2 inches of minerals in the bottom of that quart jug. If you boil away a quart of Perrier water at $20 a gallon, you're going to get as much mineral as you put on the head of a pin. A huge disparity. There's going to be nobody more disappointed than the baby boomers when they hit 50, 60, 70 years of age and they get all this arthritis and say, well, I don't know how that happened. I've been drinking Perrier my whole life. And so they're going to be disappointed. Now, not only did these cultures drink this water, this glacial milk, and get 8 to 12% and then 3 to 5% when they were 40 or 50 years of age, because it's nothing more than ground up rocks, metallic or elemental minerals. More importantly than drinking the glacial milk, week after week, month after month, year after year, generation after generation, for 2,500 to 5,000 years, depending on the culture, they irrigated with this glacial milk. And they returned literally tens of thousands of tons of these minerals, this rock dust, this rock flour, back into the soil. Their grains, fruits, vegetables, nuts, took this elemental mineral out of the soil, converted it to colloidal minerals, and the food that they eat, the grains, vegetables, fruits, and nuts they eat, are rich with these colloidal minerals. All we put in is NPK, NPK, NPK. As a result, they don't get, in their early ages, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100, they don't get heart disease, diabetes, cancer, arthritis, osteoporosis, cataracts, Alzheimer's disease. They don't have birth defects. They don't have jails full of violent criminals and drug addicts. They don't have hospitals. They don't have health insurance. My God, how could you live there? They don't have health insurance. But they live healthily to be 120, 140 because they have the raw materials to maintain and repair their bodies.
This is Dr. Wallach with the
Prime. Well, that's it for tonight, folks. If you would like to receive an information package on Dr. Wallach and his recommendations on how you can improve your personal health, right now, call 1-888-403-2405. That's 1-888-403-2405. Or 1-888-701-0502. That's 1-888-701-0502. Or if you live in the Round Valley of Arizona, call 3555. That's 3555. Well, folks, I went out and checked the shortwave radio. And I also checked the satellite weather channel. And according to the satellite weather channel, the weather across the United States is so bad that I doubt if we have many listeners to the shortwave broadcast in this country. We may have quite a few in Central and South America and Europe and maybe out in the broad Pacific, but not in the United States of America. Also, I could not receive WBCQ on our shortwave radio at all. And normally, we receive WBCQ like gangbusters. I mean, it just comes in here like the station is in our backyard. And I couldn't even get it tonight. So, I know that a lot of you are experiencing some pretty bad weather. And so I hope that, and I don't know why I'm even saying this, because I know you can't hear me. But even though you can't hear me, I hope you're taking care of yourselves. I hope nothing bad happens. I hope that you're staying warm and that you're eating and drinking the right things so that you don't get sick during the bad part of the winter, which here in Arizona is just beginning. January is really the worst month for us. So for all of you out there, from all of us here, we wish you the very best of health. We hope that you're staying warm, and we hope that you're eating and drinking the right things if you have to go out into this terrible weather. And we regret the fact that many of you are not able to listen to the broadcast. We are very happy that that those people in all of the other countries in the world are probably getting us loud and clear. And we will know in the next week or two by the letters we get from those other countries. So, from all of us here to all of you there, good night, and God bless each and every single one of you. By the way, folks, this is not the Commando March. I was looking at the wrong CD. This is Adagio for Strings by Barber, one of the most beautiful things that he wrote. You're listening to WBCQ, Monticello, Maine, USA. This has been the Hour of the Time, and I'm William Cooper. You're listening to 98.5 FM, Eager. Stay tuned now for All Oldies Most of the Time.
Just a dream, just a dream.